Around 2,500 years ago in ancient Greece, Empedocles contemplated the essential questions of the universe, including the role of love and strife. Empedocles is known as a pre-Socratic philosopher, although he was primarily a poet. In his surviving works, On Nature and Purifications, Empedocles posits that the cosmic powers of love and strife govern the four indestructible elements of the universe. Love unifies the elements with each other and draws like to like. Since then, philosophers, poets, and thinkers have contemplated what love is and how it impacts human existence and the function of the universe. From the Platonic dialogues to 20th century literature, thinkers have chronicled their thoughts on love. So why are philosophers so concerned with love? Is love that important that it commands centuries of attention from nearly every philosophical thinker? In many ways, love is what binds us together as humans and gives motivation to our lives. Today, we will explore love and its role in human life. Welcome to Open Door Philosophy. I'm Taylor Jones, and along with me is Mr. Derek Parsons.
Hello, everyone.
And Andrew Graziano.
Howdy, howdy.
And welcome to episode 62 on love. So how is everybody doing today?
I'm never very exciting. I'm good. I don't know what else to say. It's so hot outside, and I had to walk outside to start recording this. Right as I got back into the AC, I started, for the first time in my life, empathizing with cats, how they just, you know, kind of curl up on the side after they've been walking and just fall asleep in the middle of nowhere. So I get it, cats. I understand your world now.
That's all you have to say? What about that fresh haircut?
Yeah, this is a nice new... I don't even know when the last time I got a haircut was, but I finally rolled in and got the fresh cut in Mama Graziano's house, so that was good. And next time, maybe we'll be recording with video, so maybe everyone will be able to see.
We'll all need haircuts, yes.
Yeah, that'll be a big change, possibly. Maybe
oh,
we should
Lord.
Have been more
suspenseful. Am I ready for this moment? I don't know. I did get a haircut last weekend.
Very snazzy.
Yeah, it's all right. It's a typical, you know, middle-aged man haircut. Although maybe not, because I actually have hair.
Yeah,
so many dudes my age like shave their heads.
Mm-hmm. Well, because they start balding, so like I think that just once their hairline starts receding, they figure just everything.
Yeah, when I so you guys don't know this, but back in like 2014,
oh I know
2016,
oh,
yeah,
we know.
I didn't shave my head, but I trimmed it down to like
buzzed
you know a quarter
it.
Inch, and I finally grew it out. And I remember the first time we went to a barber, he said, man, at your age, if you got hair, you should grow it out.
I think that was during my time at, if you were at Magnolia, I think that was my time when I was at Magnolia starting out.
Yeah. And so you're 2019.
2015.
Yeah.
2015.
Yeah, you would have been a wee freshman or something.
And I'm pretty sure I remember you.
You surely would have known the legend of Mr. Parsons.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the shaved head. What was
so
it? Was
awful.
Like a, it was like a buzz, more of a buzz cut, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, yeah. I just set the thing on a quarter inch and just went at it. I don't, you know, looking back at those photos, I just don't know why I did that. I look like a potato. But anyway, a very handsome potato, naturally. Let's get on to how I am, speaking of me, because we don't want to talk about my hair all day long. Andrew, like you, it is hot as hell, and I don't mean that metaphorically.
Yeah.
In all my years, my so many years in Houston, I have never known it to be this hot for this long a period of
yeah,
time.
Yeah, it's different.
I mean, it's real. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's different. So anyway, I mowed the lawn this morning. I started at 7:30. I'm sure my neighbors appreciated that. But being that it's summer, and they're hopefully at work, hopefully I did not disturb their late morning slumber. But anyway, I'm good. I go back on contract Monday. And so this is really it. And we're recording in the afternoon today, which is a little different. And I feel, mm-hmm. you know, I'm usually drinking coffee, but now I feel like we should have like wine and cheese or something.
Yeah.
A charcuterie board or, you know, an aperitif mm-hmm. For dinner, before dinner.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm old, so I eat dinner at 5 p.m. There's my weekly old joke about myself. Taylor, how are you?
I'm good. Also, I mean, that makes sense if your day starts at 6 a.m., that you'd be ready for dinner at 5.
Okay, on the reels, is that a way to say it? During school, my alarm clock goes off at 4:45 a.m.
Yeah, I bet.
So,
I woke
up
at 6:30 when I was supposed to leave the house.
Yeah. I mean, and that's early for any... I mean, it's early.
Yeah.
Yeah, but by the time I get home at like 5 p.m., yeah, I'm ready for dinner. Anyway,
that's fair.
Enough of that.
Well, I'm good. I'm on my last month of summer, which compared to last week, that doesn't sound like that long. But I've been home for 2 months now, I guess, just trying to find things to do. And I'm still grandma hobbying it up, lots of crocheting. My sister said that she wanted a crochet bag, so that's what I've been doing this week, is crocheting her bag.
I was going to ask you what your project was.
That's about it. And I've been dog sitting, so super thrilling things going on here.
Love that tax-free income.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Need to report every penny. Or for all my Better Call Saul fans, you have to get a burner phone.
A burner phone for dog sitting.
Yeah.
What's the world come to? Oh, man. Okay, well, before we get going on this episode on love, which is going to be great... hey, I figured it's been a while since we've checked in at the book corner, so let's do that. All right, guys, it's been a long, hot, sweltering summer. Too hot to even read outside. But anyway, how about you guys? What's been on your reading list the last couple weeks?
Okay, I just started the third book in the trilogy I've been reading for a long time because I was so busy at school, but I just started the third book called Ruin and Rising. And it's the conclusion to this kind of fantasy epic that's inspired by Russia and, like, Russian culture instead of European. So it's kind of a cool twist on YA fantasy.
Cool. All right, Andrew. How about you?
That sounds cool.
It's no Sir Thomas More's Utopia.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I should read that again, actually. I was thinking of that last week. Books. Yeah, so... I've been having a pretty exciting summer in terms of reading. So first off, as always, we have to revisit the classical shelf. So my goal now is I'm going to try to read 15 minutes of Aristotle and 15 minutes of Plato a day. I don't care if
like
I read
in Greek
anything
and Latin,
else.
Or not Latin.
Well,
Greek?
Yeah. So depending on the material, so Plato will be a lot easier for that. Aristotle, I'm sticking to my nice and dandy Robin Waterfield translation. So we're going through the Rhetoric right now for Aristotle, which is a fantastic... Robin Waterfield and Harvey Unis's translation are great with that book. Really readable. And Plato, since we're going to be discussing a little bit of the symposium today, cracked that one open and have been going through that. So that's been a blast. Plato is hilarious.
That's what people mostly think of first when they think of Plato.
Yeah, he's actually pretty funny.
Maybe he's funny.
Talk about this today, actually.
Plato and humor.
Yeah, yeah, and the symposium too. What else? Oh, and then I'm very interested in history. So I've been trying to read something about Russian history. But it's been super boring. Taylor's book sounds much cooler than mine. So have y'all seen this Napoleon trailer that's came out?
No.
No.
Really?
Uh-uh.
Really?
Oh, really?
This is wild.
Like, really? Really? Really, really?
I'm kind of disappointed, actually.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Okay,
I've been on Threads so much lately. I haven't seen it.
Okay, so there's this new Napoleon movie with Joaquin Phoenix playing Napoleon. And it looks sick. Huh. It looks so good. And one of my friends is a big Napoleon guy, so I've been asking him on book recs.
That's funny, since Napoleon was so short. That's dad joke number one.
Yeah, so anyway, so I just got a notification when I was coming upstairs to do this podcast that my next book will be Napoleon.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm
by
so
who?
Pumped.
There's a few of them out there.
Let me see. I think it's by Robert Adams, but let me double check for our fans. Yep. Andrew Roberts.
Andrew
by
Roberts.
By Andrew Roberts. Napoleon, A Life. Sounds cool.
Wow. Yeah.
What about y'all?
Well, I applaud Taylor's complete removal of herself from academic work. I'm so glad you're enjoying some fiction. I've delved into some of that as well. Andrew, I'm super impressed with your attention to academic work during the summer. Me? I've been kind of all over the place. So I've, I think the last bookshelf I said I read Life is Hard, which was just, it was great. It was great. So I thought I'd do some fiction. I'm like, what better fiction than to read Iris Murdoch, who's a philosopher. But anyway, I read, I believe it was her first book, is called Under the Net, and it's a comedy. That's sort of an absurdist comedy, which was a pretty entertaining, I have to say. I enjoyed it quite a lot. The main character is totally squirrely, and it's a lot of fun. And then one of my other favorite philosophers who knew Iris Murdoch was Mary Midgley. And I've never read her memoirs, her autobiography, and so I started reading that. I have about 30 pages left. So it's called The Owl of Minerva, which is a fantastic title. And it has to do with a Hegel quote, but I won't get into it. And then finally, the last book I'm reading, so I'm reading Owl of Minerva and this next one kind of simultaneously. So speaking of Robin Waterfield, who you mentioned, Andrew, and who we interviewed on episode 43, I'm reading his latest book, which is a biography on Plato, which is just simply called Plato of Athens. And it's really great. So that's what I've been digging into.
That's awesome. Sounds really cool. Yeah. That you've been sending us some of the Mary Midgley excerpts, and it looks really funny.
Yeah.
Looks really funny.
You're being kind. I've certainly sent you more than a few.
No.
No, Mary Midgley cracks me up. She is so... She's so fun to read, and
so
which
sassy.
She's just a sassy British lady, and she's really funny. When I read her very first book, I'm not even sure what the point of the book was, but it was so entertaining to read that that I've just kind of hooked. I'm like, I gotta read more about this lady. Mm-hmm. You know, I started reading some older work, and she's going toe to toe with Richard Dawkins, and man, it's she's a very entertaining writer. You know, it's really great when you can have a philosopher who is also an engaging writer. And Midgley is one of those people. And, you know, you might say that that I love Mary Midgley's philosophy. And there's our segue.
I think you could say that.
Well, I do, yes. All right, everybody, this is our first of two episodes on the topic of love. The second episode deals very specifically with someone's paper. We'll talk about that in a minute. But just as a disclaimer, as we get going here, love is a huge topic. It's something that the poets and the novelists and the playwrights and the philosophers have written about for ages. And it's one of those fantastical, mysterious things about being human is love in all of its various ways. So no way we can cover all that in like the next 45 minutes. So that's our disclaimer. But our next episode I do want to preview happens to do with a particular person's paper that's being published soon. And that is Mr. Andrew Graziano. Could you tell us a little bit about your paper and then to tease us for next episode?
Yeah, certainly. So that's very kind of you. Both of y'all to allow me to do an episode all for myself, which is cool. But basically, the premise of the paper depends on a little bit about what we'll be talking today at the end. Love is a driver for motivation. Primarily, the idea builds upon something that we'll see stemming from all the way back to Plato. But Plato's not in the paper. It's the idea Plato gives is that love can provide something of meaning in your life, or at least a driver. So this idea has been kind of kicked around the corner a little bit and recently picked back up by some philosophers that we'll talk about today. And basically, I make a very controversial but kind of a very Platonist point that if you love something, no matter if that's philosophy or a partner or a car or an activity or whatever, that is an object that is necessarily something, one, that you can love, and that it is a object worthy of love, which are actually two surprisingly controversial opinions that I hold. So I'm really excited to talk about it more next week, and thank both of you. I appreciate it, having the ability to discuss it more.
Oh, don't thank us yet. We're gonna grill you, man.
I expect it. Good.
We'll destroy.
Good.
I'm just teasing.
No, I love it.
No, it's an absolute thrill. And congratulations on
thank
that.
You.
It's very exciting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Very exciting. Well, this episode, another disclaimer, will be mostly Western philosophically oriented. I can't say that I know much about love in the East, as little as I've studied it, but I've studied some. Anyway, I'm just heading down another rabbit trail with that. I wanna dig into that. But anyway, you know, I just wanna tell you guys something. I love you. I love you guys. I love
Thank
you guys.
That's very sweet.
I do. You know what else I love? Pizza.
Pizza.
What?
I do. And I also have great love for my favorite English football team, who's actually Welsh, and that's Swansea City AFC. I love them so much. And of course, I love my wife very much as well. In fact, I would say I love her the most. But
yeah, good.
Yeah, good, right? Let's hope I don't like the football team more than my wife. You know, to the detriment of many marriages, I'm sure. Although it's probably American football. Anyway.
Yeah.
So we're doing an episode on love. Everyone experiences love in different ways. It makes a very easy thing to, like, go into as far as an entry topic for philosophy. It's probably right up there with, like, death. What are the two or three or four big things we experience when we're young growing up? Well, the first time we fall in love, the first time we realize we love something, like our teddy bear or something. Of course, death, obviously, that plagues everyone about at age 5 or 6. So anyway, yay, so good. Love. So lots of questions about love. What are some questions you guys can think of that people just typically ask about love?
One that comes to mind is asking, why do you love something? Like, what's the cause or reason?
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. I think something is, do you really love something, or do you just really like it?
Yeah, where's the dividing line between that? Yeah.
Which is, like, really important, too. And that's another one. Sorry, my mind is just, like, so excited to talk about this. So I'm jumping all over the place. But I think there's another one, too, in there that's, like, very closely connected. You said you love your wife, you love favorite football team, you love us, you love, I'm sure, your animals. Is that the same type of love, or is that all different types of love? And if they're the same, what the heck does that mean? Is love in degrees?
Yeah, great questions. Do we have any control over who we love? Like, is there some agency in who we love? Or if we're talking about romantic love anyway, and how it's portrayed in a lot of movies and books, you know, does it just smack you upside the head and you have no choice in it? You've fallen in love with that person. And that leads to questions about, like, well, is love rational? I mean, I think Taylor is the one who said, like, you know, why do I love this particular, you know, if we go down that road, like, why do I love this person? Well, now we're starting to talk about a checklist, and we're coming up with traits and other things, like, as to why we love this person, and if we can apply it to another person, those same traits, would we, if that person had those traits, would we love that person? So anyway, that's kind of what I think of.
Yeah, that last question's, I mean, it's a little tiny bit off topic, but is love rational? So we're going to talk about 6 people today. We're going to talk about Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas and Nozick, and Frankfurt and Wolf. And I would be willing to almost bet that at least 4 out of the 6 does not think love is rational.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Well, that gets us to our first topic. So the first thing we're going to do is talk about different types of love. And one of the things about the English language is that it is so incredibly inadequate when it comes to trying to just use language to talk about love. We have one word, and we can apply modifiers like "I really love you," or, you know, we can get Shakespearean and be like, you know, "Oh, Juliet is the sun," or something like that. But at the end of the day, we're like, we just got one word, and it's love, which I tried to express earlier with all my different loves.
It's interesting you use the word inadequate.
Oh, maybe I should have said deficient.
Or deficient too. I mean, I think so. The idea there is that because love is such a difficult, or maybe not difficult, in English is such a word that we kind of are forced to blanket with a bunch of different things. It doesn't fulfill what the true meaning of love is. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. You would think that with as many words as we have in the English language that mean almost the same thing, how many words we have synonym on synonym on synonym for, that we would have more than one word for something like love when so many other languages have 4 or 5, but we just took one.
Oh, I'm a fan of it. Is that controversial?
What?
Yeah.
No. I'd love to hear why.
I'm intrigued.
Well,
I mean, it does definitely leave room for some interpretation, which can be very beneficial.
Well, I see both of y'all's point, and I think it's a really great point, actually. Where I would push back is, I think that love is a very special thing, and it's very rare. And I think where you're going to see that, and I think all of you would agree with that. And so it is kind of special that we mm-hmm. have one word that we oftentimes use in a really bad way, I think. Like, oh, yeah, I love this crappy Barbie movie. Yeah, exactly. Or
crappy Barbie movie? I'm so excited
not
to see
Barbie
it. What are you
movie?
Talking about?
Yeah.
You want to watch that Oppenheimer film, don't you?
I do.
They both look so good.
No, they both look
really
good.
Yeah, they do. They both look good.
Anyway, you love this crappy Barbie movie.
Yeah. And it's just like, I think we just use it a lot. Our first three people, and this moves us great to our next topic. Huh? So the Greeks, on the other hand, had a bunch of different ways of saying love. Like Taylor said, we wrote down 3 of them. A bunch of different philosophers couldn't agree what the best form of love was. They couldn't. They would argue about it. And it's nice. We can just use a nice little modifier in front of our word instead of having to memorize a bunch of different declensions and a bunch of different ways of saying love.
Do you think we overuse the word love for things that we don't love?
Yes, I do.
Oh, totally.
Do you think that, Taylor?
Oh, most certainly. Yeah. But do you think that would be any better if we had multiple words for love, or people should just use the other words for a strong liking that we already have?
That's a great point. Yeah, that's a great point. I think that we might just use like the strongest. I don't know, because like my mind is wrapped up in English.
I'm just thinking like a person at Taco Bell, like, I feel very strongly about my like for this burrito.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like, I love the crunchy wrap or whatever, the cheesy gordita crunch. I love the cheesy gordita crunch. That's a great example, because I've probably said that before.
You're very passionate about
it. It's so stupid. It's like the most stupid thing ever. I don't know, Taylor. Maybe I would. Maybe I wouldn't. But I definitely think it's overused and at a detriment to us.
Well, let's talk about these different Greek definitions of the word, and maybe that'll provide us some more talking points about this specific topic. So the first Greek word that we're going to talk about for love is the word eros. On the surface, eros means erotic or passionate love. Erotos means intimate love. But that's not really how the Greeks necessarily used it. Today we associate it with eroticism. I like to think of it more in terms of just something that you're very passionate about. One of the things that the Greeks were really concerned about was it was very dangerous for them to lose control of themselves, to lose control of their rational self and give in to, especially in the Platonic idea, their urges or their emotions. And so eros was a word they used for love, but it was I don't want to say it was like a warning or a bad word or anything, but it's like, this is the one you need to keep an eye on, because eros is passion. And so if I translate that today to my earlier example, I have eros for the Swansea City AFC team. I'm very passionate about them. I certainly don't want to be erotic with them. That's funny.
Yeah, that would be good.
So anyway, that's Eros. And you could probably think of things in your life that you are very passionate about. And you can obviously see why this works out in terms of sexuality or sexual desire. Obviously, a person is probably quite passionate about that as well. But it doesn't have to be exclusive to that.
Let me say two things real quick.
Yeah, please.
So, yeah, I think you did a great job with that. Eros, and you can think about it too, as a type of love that is raving and mad. It's like you said, it's uncontrollable. And we can think of, you know, scenes in Greek tragedy that are alluded to all the time. The thing I just want to take issue with, Mr. Parsons, this is the complication of Greeks, and this is why I think Plato's so funny. When Plato says, the only thing I know is the art of love, the love that he references is the erotic love. In Greek, it is ta erotika. That's really, really interesting, I think. At least Socrates, not Plato, at least Socrates is somewhat, and we'll talk about this in a second, is somewhat saying that the eros is the highest form of love. And that's all I'm going to say for now.
Okay. All right, cool.
The next form of love that we have is agape. And at least for me, if you grew up in the Christian church, you may be familiar with the term agape because it's referenced or used in reference to the relationship between man and the love of God. And just generally, it characterizes a love that's sacrificial and transcendent of circumstance. And in Christianity, it's known as the highest form of love that God gives to us in the sacrifice of Christ.
Yeah, I've sometimes read, Andrew, I'd be curious your take on this. I've sometimes read that the Christian notion of agape is different than the Greek notion of agape. My section on Frankfurt kind of addresses that, but I'm curious what your thought is since you've studied Greek a bit more.
Yeah, I was just thinking this. I don't know if I've ever even seen that word, like in the older, in like Plato or Aristotle. I'm not sure. Like I was trying to find it in some collections, the Perseus collections, but I couldn't find it. I think the Greeks might have thought, okay, when I say the Greeks, right, I mean like the classic Greeks in Plato and Aristotle's time. It's about a 400-year difference between that and New Testament Greek, which does change a lot. These philosophical Greeks, Plato might have thought that this is something more like a form of love that humans cannot have, which is really cool and is compatible.
Like can only be associated with the good or the world of forms.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And then the last word we're going to talk about is a word that probably people are also familiar with, but maybe not as much as agape, is the word philia. You'll know that from city Philadelphia, which is, its little slogan is the city of brotherly love. Philia is this affectionate regard or friendship between equals. It's definitely something you would use. It's something I would use with you guys. I have philia for you. It's between equals. It's sort of about family, but family has another word, and we're not going to talk about that. But family can be sort of be incorporated into that, depending on its interpretation. It's about community, which is on a broader scale. But typically, philia is the type of love that we feel for people who are in our lives consistently and that we care greatly for. But maybe the definition of love is slightly different for them, like, say, my friends versus my wife or my children.
Yeah, that's good.
So a lot of philosophers have had lots to say about love over the centuries. We've chosen six from really three different eras in philosophy, the ancient, the medieval, and the contemporary. So we're going to go over those overviews of kind of the history of what those philosophers thought on different forms of love. And we're going to start with ancient Greece. And we're going to start with Plato because, you know, all of philosophy is but a footnote. Plato.
Of course. We can't forget our favorite guy here.
Yeah.
So one of Plato's biggest works involving love is the Symposium, which may come at no surprise if you're familiar with it, where a bunch of philosophers get together to debate the meaning of love by giving speeches and going around and just contesting what their perspectives on love is. And from what I found, the conclusion that Plato comes to is that the highest love is the philosopher's love of the truth, which is contained in the forms. And this distinguishes the philosopher from the common man, because the philosopher pursues only truth rather than some worldly passion. And then from here, we have the coining of Platonic love, or a love that unites souls by uniting them with the truth. Like Andrew mentioned before, there's the term ta erotica, which is translated to the art of love. And Plato says, "The only thing I say I know is the art of love." From the Stanford Encyclopedia, they translated this as eros, to love, combined with the verb eroton, to ask questions. And this is tied to conversation or speech making, which then is related to wisdom, or the hunger for wisdom and philosophy. In the symposium, one thing that I find personally very, very interesting is Socrates' conversation with Diotima, who she's the only woman included in the symposium. And it's contested whether she actually existed or not, but it's important that she was included at all. And she has this idea of the ladder of love that puts six forms of love in a hierarchy. And the bottom is desire and lust as the least important or least gratifying, almost, forms of love. And appreciation of the form of beauty is at the top. So from the bottom, we have love of one individual body, then love of beautiful bodies, then love of the beauty a soul can have, then above that is love of beautiful public institutions, and then the love for knowledge in general. Finally, at the top, we have the love for beauty itself. And as you go up the ladder, it gets more abstract and less concrete and tied to a physical representation of anything.
You know, in some other universe, I'm probably a Platonist. And I become a Platonist just about every time I read anything by Plato. Mm-hmm. I think this is beautiful. Plato's explanation.
I knew you would say this.
I think Plato's explanation of what love is in the symposium is just beautiful. And if you know Plato's philosophy well enough, this links quite well with the tripartite soul concept of we're made of three parts. One is our urges, one is our emotions, and one is our reason, our intellect. And this ladder of love, with Plato, who so often references these hierarchies, which all extend towards the good. Mm-hmm. You know, we begin, like you said, Taylor, with love for an individual body, right? We're seeing another body and we're hot for it. Mm-hmm. And that's those urges, right? And then we feel emotion once we get to know that person a little better. Mm-hmm. We see their soul and we become emotionally attached to them. And then that top, you know, that reason or the intellect, we ascend towards the love of beauty itself, which of course is just a subset of the good. Mm-hmm. I won't go on any longer, but every year I teach it, I just fall in love with Plato all over again.
Yeah.
Let me just say two things. I don't want to rain on the parade.
Oh, that's okay.
But I get it. Like, it's a very beautiful, it's very, very beautiful, which is probably the point.
I'm not saying it's necessarily right, but God,
No, I get it. I think it's great. But I do want to raise a little bit of skepticism to this. And not in the way of raising an idea, but this is not necessarily Plato's idea. This is Socrates' introducted idea. The reason I say that is if we look at the very beginning of the symposium, Socrates, first off, I would love to do an episode on this because this is probably the best written dialogue out of any. It's fun, it's beautiful, it's great. Socrates is not the teller, it's retold, first of all. Second of all, when we meet up with Socrates, Socrates is going around like an idiot at the beginning of this. He's going like an idiot. So listen, they're going to a party. So this random guy who's retelling this story finds Socrates, meets up with him. Socrates agrees to invite him to this really famous party. This guy starts walking with Socrates, and Socrates, he's so enraptured in his own thoughts that he just will stop and stare and wander off. He looks like a fool. And so the narrator, by the time he just gets fed up with Socrates, he goes to the party and Socrates shows up 45 minutes later. And everyone at the party makes fun of him because he looks like an idiot. So when Socrates says, the only thing that I know is the art of loving, it's like, yeah, Socrates, you're in love with your ideas. Great. Look at how you are.
And that's before the wine.
Yep. We should do an episode on that. It's such a great dialogue.
I mean, it's the best you one. Know, the amount of episodes we can create is infinite. So put it on the list. All right. Well, there's Plato's overview. His great student, Aristotle, of course, had something to say about it as well. So, Taylor?
Yeah. So next we have Aristotle, like Mr. Parsons said, and the idea of philia. And in the Ethics, we see motivation emerge here. We have love as a path to virtue. And if you know anything about Aristotle, you know that he is all about virtue and humans achieving virtue through self-betterment. What I found on Ethics is that Aristotle talks a lot about friendship here, which is interesting because Plato also talks about a non-romantic love. So we're seeing love here kind of separated from our romantic conception, which I think is interesting coming from the American culture where we mostly perceive love as romantic. But he characterizes three different types of friendship. One, friendship based on utility or mutual benefit. So think of a study partner. You study so you can both get something out of it. And then you have friendship based on pleasure, where two people are drawn to each other's wit. So this is a funny friend, an acquaintance, like a school friend that you're not super close with. And then you have friendship based on goodness, where two people admire the good in each other and help each other strive for goodness. And only friendship based on goodness is long-lasting because it deals with the essential nature of friendship, that two people need to help each other become good or better in a relationship. Because needs and desires change over time, while goodness is an enduring quality. So that means that friendship based on goodness endures, and it also encompasses the other two, mm-hmm. where you have your needs met and you derive pleasure from a relationship. And he also talks about how love should be proportional to merit in a relationship. And this can be unequal in something like a parent-child relationship, but the gap can't be too big or one person be too much more virtuous than the other because the relationship would then be impossible. He says that the true mark of friendship is to love more than you are loved. So you shouldn't be selfish and pursuing more gratification for yourself if you're not also giving that to other people. And he also connects friendship to justice because they both tie communities together and create this important bond between people.
Great. It's really good.
Boy, let me just say I love his emphasis on friendship because I think, like you said, mm-hmm. Taylor, we do often get wrapped up in this romantic notion of love. Mm-hmm. But just like we do with romantic relationships, we're like, we're making the checklist. We're like, why do we like this person? Why do we love this person? Mm-hmm. It's very much so true of friendship as well. And we have mm-hmm. more friends than we do romantic partners throughout our life. Yeah. Of course, you're like, why am I friends with this person? And you begin to realize as you get older, you're like, I'm just friends with this person because we're on the volleyball team together. Or, you know, mm-hmm. for me, I'm just friends with this person because I work with them and we're around each other all the time. It doesn't mean, you know, a mutual benefit or a utility type of relationship is bad or wrong. It just means it's different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're like, ah, that person over there, they're wearing an Iron Maiden shirt. I love Iron Maiden. And, you know, you guys start mm-hmm. talking. It's the beginning of a friendship. But, you know, your entire friendship can't be predicated on your love of Iron Maiden. Okay. It's got to transcend that at some point. And that's where mm-hmm. you eventually get to this other aspect of goodness, right? Admiring the other person mm-hmm. for who they are. And of course, that develops over time. You can't just meet a person and care about the goodness that they have or something. The discovery of this is organic and it happens over time. That's the beauty of friendship. That's the beauty of romantic relationships as well. But I like the emphasis mm-hmm. on friendship here rather than the romantic relationship.
I do too. I think we forget how important our friends are when at least in kind of the American conception, romantic love is the peak. You can't get better than that. And then people get so focused on finding a romantic connection that they forget that their friends serve just as important of a role and that platonic love does so much for us. and that the goodness of a friendship can do even more good in our lives than the goodness of a romantic relationship.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a plethora of psychological papers written about the importance of friendship and loneliness and all that stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Well, these first two that we've looked at, we can categorize Plato as being eros love. We can categorize Aristotle as being philia. So let's move on to agape in the Middle Ages. And that brings us to Andrew.
Yeah, and it's a really nice segue between Plato and Aristotle, just perfect. If we're thinking that Aristotle, his idea of love is willing excellence for another person, virtue. You're wanting your friend, the person you're friends with is kind of on a similar virtue level as you, kind of like your experience points. And so you're wanting them to be better, not for your own sake, but for their sake. Aquinas takes it a step further. And Aquinas, his writing style is great. I can't believe we haven't talked about him. He starts from ground zero and works his way up. And I'm going to skip a lot of that because we'd be here forever. Just like any great philosophy paper, we'd be here forever discussing what a period is. So we're going to move on. Aquinas eventually will end at the point where he defines love as a movement of the will towards goodness. So that's love itself. And this is a really cool distinction that he makes, a difference between love and loving. Loving is willing the good of the other as other. That's a really great translation of Aquinas. Willing the good of the other as other, not for your own sake, but for their sake. And there's a very similar connection between Aristotle and Aquinas, where Taylor, you said, I believe, that for Aristotle, you will want your friend or whatever to, what did you say, be as virtuous as they can without you, or be more virtuous than you or something?
Something like that.
She's like, I don't know what I said.
That you love your friend more than the love that you receive, and you want them to be virtuous.
Exactly, exactly. So in the same sense, a really good love will be loving and willing them more goodness than they could ever give back to you. The perfect, you know, ding 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 example for Aquinas is who do you think? It's Jesus.
I'm going
Christ.
With God or Jesus.
Yeah, it's Jesus and God. And God shows us what love is through his son Jesus, who loved in a way that could not for a Christian be reciprocated. And it's really interesting too, Aquinas incorporates some Plato in there. I don't know if he even intended to, because I don't know if they even were reading Plato. I don't know. But God for Plato, one of God's aspects is just love. God is the form of love. So whenever we're engaged in love, we're engaged kind of with God. It's not, and I think this is different than Aristotle, and it's not different than Aristotle. It might be different than for Plato. And for our American conception, Western conception, 20th century, 21st century, love is not a feeling, and this is a major difference. Love is not a feeling, it's not an emotion, it's an act of the will. We have to choose every day to seek the good of another person. And so loving is an act of the will. He does differentiate between two types of love. There's kind of a selfish love where you desire to possess someone. Maybe this is like an objectification of someone. And then there's another kind of better love, which is a love of friendship kind of too, that involves some kind of aspect of God, the good. That friendship, the best friendships, the ones that include love, are oriented around the good. And that kind of friendship, it's selfless, just like we were talking about. Love of friendship, similarly for Aquinas, is the highest form of good. It's something that we need to strive for, but it's also a recognition with another person that the relationship needs to be oriented around the good, not for our own self-interest. I'm not friends with Mr. Parson because he can give me some cool education tips, or he can, I don't know, loan me some cool books. No, it's because I have a desire to see him flourish. And so that's, I think, a really Aristotelian component. It's like a beef Wellington. It's wrapped up, sewed together, stuck in the oven, give it a little spice. It's great.
I love a good beef Wellington.
I've never had one, but they look amazing.
Oh, man.
I don't even know what that is, if I'm being honest.
It's well known for the Gordon Ramsay, you know, every episode of Kitchen, whatever, Hell's Kitchen, right?
I love British food. Love a good meat pie.
Ugh. Yeah.
What? Anyway, yeah, I love how Aquinas takes Aristotle and tries to harmonize Aristotle's ideas with late medieval Christianity. And I also love how, in a way, really, it reaches mm-hmm. all the way back to Plato with this conception of the good God. And I please don't get onto me here. God could very easily be the good in this type of conception of that. The good is love. And so if God is love, then God is the good.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You're kind of just swapping words around there. But in a way, with Plato's hierarchies, obviously, who's going to be at the top? Well, it's going to be God, because God is love. God doesn't do actions of love. God just, like, is. And mm-hmm. that's, like, what the conception of the good is. It's just good. It's just like God. I mean, he's also omnibenevolent, so good.
Yeah.
I'm just riffing, but that's what comes to mind.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. You want to come at me on that, Andrew?
No. I have nothing to say about that. I have something funny to say. But Taylor, okay. If you want to say anything about that, feel free.
I don't have anything to add. I agree with Mr. Parsons on that.
If anyone's curious, Aquinas is fun, but he kind of, like, Aquinas reads like a cookbook. You know what I mean? You're not going to go through a cookbook, probably, and, like, look through. You might, like, look through every page, but you're not going to read through, like, every part of the recipe until you're making it, right?
Yeah.
You know? So that's kind of how Aquinas is, because these books in the Summa, mm-hmm. the one you're going to read probably, it's 3 volumes, it's huge. And so I was trying to cite my sources for this. This is how I came up with it. He discusses love in the first part of the second part of the book in questions 26, 27, and 28. What a nightmare.
Yeah. There's some books out there like that are just really, it's really awful. Big. Swinburne, The Coherence of Theism. Oh my God, just forget it.
Yeah.
Let's hop from the late medieval period and talk about some more contemporary philosophers. So, Andrew, you're going to tell us about Robert Nozick.
Yeah, we should play some like time travel music here because we're jumping through time, literally. We are in like the 20th century now, which is super big jump. And part of that, and this is important, is meaning and love. It's important to people. I think that the Enlightenment kind of pushed it into this romantic category, and it's not been that important of a focus. Mm-hmm. But it was important for some people in the early analytic tradition and in the continental tradition too. But let's get to Nozick now. So what we're probably most familiar with Nozick is his Anarchy, State, and Utopia, a political philosopher. We haven't yet thought about love as a in kind of these terms, even though mm-hmm. love as marriage has marriage is a first religious institution, but also a very important political institution too. And so Nozick, I don't know if he's necessarily thinking, I mean, definitely informed by this political thinking about marriage and love. And so Nozick, he writes this essay called Love's Bond, which pretty much gives you the kicker in the title. Nozick defines love as a kind of union between two people. And the union idea is that two lovers become lovers. Love exists in the relationship when their well-being becomes intertwined. And so there's no kind of distinction between two people who might just be first dating. There's not going to be a kind of thing where on the first date, you know, the guy tells the girl that he loves her and it's really awkward. No, that's not it for Nozick. It's not a kind of liking. It's a kind of being attached. It's not an attraction either. It's an attachment, not in the clingy sense. It's a time. Love exists in a relationship when two lovers become one, where they see themselves not as an I, but as a we.
Hmm.
So what's going to happen here? It kind of happens in stages. So the first stage that Nozick goes through in a couple's relationship where love will exist is that these lovers will start to affirm each other's worth and their value. And so that's going to be a mutual recognition. Say they're going to go to dinner, then they're going to want to start spending more time. They really like spending time with each other. And eventually they're going to say, you know, Taylor, you mentioned this earlier. You said romantic love is placed as a premium, but friends are important. For Nozick, love, like your partner, is going to be that number one friend, the most important person, the one you're going to want to spend all your time with. And that's going to be in the first stage. Once they're the most important person in your life, we ship that to the second stage. This union, love is starting to blossom here. The second stage is where we start seeing this union occur. This is really more political and economic. These two people will start pooling their resources. They're going to start making decisions together in the sense that they're going to see themselves economically as a we, and they're going to have a shared identity, maybe the same last name. They're going to start co-owning cars. They're going to start signing leases together, right? And so that puts them on a single path, a unit together. In almost a destiny, they're going to have, you know, their future is going to be together. Mm-hmm. That's not a stage. I think, you know, Mr. Parsons, unless something's happened in the last like 6 months, Taylor, Mr. Parsons, I think you're the only person who's really had this kind of union to the extent that Nozick is talking about.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really curious what your thoughts on this are, because I think it is interesting. Let me say one more thing before I get your opinion, because it's important. Nozick thinks that this is a very, very difficult thing to do. And here I agree with him. But the fact that two people become one, this union is established, both in terms of personal and with their resources, it's going to be something that gives that package much more happiness and much more fulfillment and much more completeness than they could achieve by themselves.
That's interesting. Let me ask you a clarifying question. Does Nozick just speak about this in terms of romantic partners?
Yeah, that's okay. Interesting. I think so, yeah, in this essay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this particular essay. Yeah, let me tell you, there's nothing more romantic than having a car title together.
Or a shared bank account, right?
Or a shared bank account. Oh my gosh, beautiful. I mean, when you both have the same credit card, wow. But no, this is great. This is union, right? You know, like so many of these topics that we talk about, I've never entirely just sat down and totally worked out my complete philosophical view of this topic. And, you know, so one minute I'm like, yeah, Plato makes perfect sense. It's beautiful. The next minute I'm like, Nozick, yeah, let's share a car title together. So I guess what I want to say at this very moment about it is, I mean, I think he's right. And for this particular type of relationship, this particular type of loving relationship, I suppose the three of us could own a car title together, but that'd be weird. And so I do think, gosh, I think about more and more, I don't know if it's like, oh, I'm getting older or whatever, but I think about more and more about the delicacies and the risk-taking that a romantic relationship is. Because not only just things like property, like money and cars, but when you start forming a family.
Yeah, exactly. Discusses this.
Yeah, when you start, well, even if you don't have children, your life shared with that other person becomes your life. The I does disappear and it becomes we. And this is why things like if there's a tragic death of one of the people in the couple, that other person just completely destroyed. And the reason for that is like they share that life together. This house that I live in with Kirsten is not my house. It's not her house. It's our house. And it represents an entire universe that can only exist if she and I share it together as one. And so when I think of people who are dating, they've been together with this person for a long time, they've met this person's family, they've gotten to know the family, you get engaged and everything becomes more connected because you've been together for a year or two or three, and then if for some reason that falls apart, it's dramatic.
Yep.
Because there's so much on the line. And I say risky not because like, you know, you want to play fast and loose with it, like that type of risk. But the vulnerability of it, oh, it just crushes me when I think of something like that falling apart for a person. So whatever that has to do with Nozick, that's my thoughts on it.
No, I love it. Ha, get it? I think it's super interesting. Definitely a different take than we've heard so far, but it's really interesting. And Taylor, what do you think about this? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that there's a way for both Plato to be correct,
for sure,
in a way, and Nozick to also be correct in different types of love. And that's not something that we like to think about, is how much of a risk that we take when we love somebody romantically and your life starts to become their life and you have the same friends and you live in the same place and you have so many shared things that if it doesn't work, you stand to also lose not only that person, but a lot of the things that you built together can no longer exist just for you. If you have all the same friends, it's weird if it's no longer the couple together, you start to kind of split friends naturally and things just fall apart completely. You lose almost your whole life, or you can. And I think that's such an interesting way to think about love, as like starting to form a domestic bond, which is so risky.
Well, you saying that, Taylor, mm-hmm. just the word finally popped in my head. What we're talking about here is the dissolving of identity.
Exactly. Right?
That's why it's such a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly. Not just because who gets the cat, you know, yep. It's your identity. And when your identity disappears, mm-hmm. well, then you disappear. Well, that's hard. It's hard because now you're rebuilding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and these last two philosophers that we're going to look at are especially important to our next episode, because I believe Andrew responds to not necessarily our first person, Harry Frankfurt, but he certainly responds to someone who responded to Frankfurt, which was Susan Wolfe. So let's talk about them very quickly. They're both American philosophers. They're both contemporary and still alive. Frankfurt is 92, I believe. Harry Frankfurt. When Frankfurt talks about what exactly that love is, or that a person loves a thing, it's something that someone cares quite a lot about. Love is the most authoritative form of caring. Caring infuses the world with meaning. It shapes the aims and the interest that the pursuit that gives meaning to our lives. He also mentions things, this sounds very much like Plato in some ways when you're talking about the tripartite soul, is there's a lot of things that makes love very less clear and very less pure. And he lists off things like infatuation, lust, obsession, possessiveness, dependency. Things like that can cloud what true or clear love is. And he also mentions, you know, we're talking about romantic relationships with Nozick. This is a quote from his paper. Among relationships between humans, the love of parents for their infants or small children is the species of caring that comes closest to offering recognizably pure instances of love. So slight difference there from Nozick. Now, I briefly want to go over the four necessary features of love for any variety, by the way. So the first one, which is a little confusing, is that love consists most basically in a disinterested concern for the well-being or flourishing of the person who is loved. Now, that the reason that's confusing, because you're like, how can I like love something that I'm disinterested in? But it's the disinterest in yourself. In other words, kind of similar to what I think Taylor said with perhaps it was Aristotle, that the love for ourselves completely disappears, and or rather the self-interest that we have for ourselves completely disappears, and our energy mm-hmm. is placed into the well-being or the flourishing of that particular person. That's what love is. So there's that aspect of it. Frankfurt also says under disinterested love that the beloved is always the final end. So you can think of Kant here and means and ends. Love cannot be transactional because we get some personal gain out of it. I remember thinking about utility earlier with one particular form of friendship with Aristotle. It can't work that way. The person or the beloved is the final end within itself or within themselves. The next is that love has to be personal. So agape love for everyone is not the same for love of a spouse, nor a copy of that particular person. Agape, he says, is too broad. You have to have a personal love. He uses an example, I think it's him, uses an example of a homeless person. You're driving down the road, a homeless person is there, asks for money, you give them money, and you're like, I have agape love for this person because they're a human being, and I love all things, and all humans. But you drive off and you forget about this homeless person. You don't know who they are. You have no connection to them, whatever. And he says, so in this way, you don't really have love for this homeless person in the agape sense, because agape is too broad, because you don't have a personal connection with this person. And so, similar to Nozick, the more you become enmeshed with a person, the more personal that bond is, the more real or clear love is. Third, you have this identification with the beloved. Again, kind of ties in with what Nozick said. The interest in the beloved is this ongoing, evolving sort of thing. Again, you can think of the homeless person. It's not some single action, right? So there's a development of relationship that happens over time. And then finally, and I don't know if controversial is the right word to use, but he also says love is not a matter of choice. And then we get into all kinds of discussions about free will that we won't get into right now. But he says, quote, love is not a matter of choice, but is determined by conditions that are outside of our immediate voluntary control. Again, we could spend the next 20 minutes on that particular line, because it's a question of, like, can we be free if we are still determined? If you're determined to love this person, are we still free, etc.? But nonetheless, love creates this volitional necessity, he calls it. Let's say person A knows that she could and should stop loving person B because he's no good, but she cannot bring herself to actually stop loving him. Her will is not strong enough. One of the things we can't really decide for ourselves is whether or not we live or die. I can't think about my heart stopping and my heart stop. And so in a similar way, because we can't generally decide if we want to stay alive or not, of course we could commit suicide, but for most of us, this is not something we actually want to do. Love is very similar in this way, according to Frankfurt. So there's a very brief Frankfurt overview. So it brings us to Susan Wolf, who is also still alive. She's 70.
Just retired.
Just retired. Okay, very good. American philosopher. She takes Frankfurt's works and acknowledges him and builds on it, on this idea of love. So she says, love is not a feeling, but rather a way of life. I really like that idea. She defines love as, quote, a deep and abiding commitment to the well-being of another person. And we see that in Frankfurt's work. We see that in Aristotle's work. This commitment is based on a deep understanding and appreciation of the other person, and it's motivated by the desire to make the other person happy. So in this way, love can't be selfish. Again, very similar to Frankfurt. Nor can it be about what we can get from that other person, but rather what we can give to them. It means the best for others, even if it means sacrificing one's own happiness. She has this quote where she talks about this, even if it means sacrificing one's own happiness. Quote, when I visit my brother in the hospital, or help my friend move, or stay up all night sewing my daughter a Halloween costume, I act neither for egoistic reasons nor for moral ones. I do not believe that it is better for me that I spend a depressing hour in a drab, cramped room seeing my brother irritable and in pain, that I risk back injury trying to get my friend's sofa safely down two flights of stairs, or that I forego hours of much-wanted sleep to make sure that the wings will stand out at a good angle from the butterfly costume my daughter wants to wear. I act neither out of self-interest nor out of duty or any other sort of impersonal or impartial reason. Rather, I act out of love.
Beautiful.
It is. Mm-hmm. I think she differentiates here from Frankfurt's last point that love is not something that happens to us. It is something that we choose. And we choose to love someone because we believe that they are worth loving. We choose to commit to them and make them a part of our lives. So you can see lots of crossovers with lots of other philosophers we talked about recently. But that's Susan Wolf's. And I believe your paper responds to this in a way, Andrew.
Yep. I'm excited to talk more about it next week, but I think Susan Wolfe is, I mean, that last passage about willing to sew your daughter's Halloween costume after you've had a long day at work or whatever, I think that's really beautiful.
It is.
And I think it's really true, too, which makes it even better. I think there's a lot of great stuff in Susan Wolfe. She's really, really a great, very accomplished American philosopher.
Okay, everyone. We thank you so much for listening to this first episode on love, and we really hope you tune in 2 weeks from now when we talk about Andrew's paper in response to some of these philosophers we talked about. It's going to be very exciting, and we're looking forward to it tremendously.
We would love to hear from you on our socials at Open Door Philosophy, and we'll have a post up for this episode, and we would love to know what you think about love. And if you would like to, head on over to our YouTube that Andrew is working very hard on. And as he said at the beginning, we may have some video podcasts up very soon for you all.
The world's not ready for me.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the plug, Taylor. Yeah, slowly growing, but surely. But anyway, thank you all so much for listening to today's episode. And thank you as well to Kevin MacLeod for the use of his free music in the intro and outro. We love it.
Ah.
Anyways, thank you once again. And remember, when your life is in need of some philosophy, the door is always open. Thank you.
Love you.
Bye.
Okay. Yay. That was a good one.